This is tape 3 of an interview with John Farquharson. The date is the 27th of March, 23. We're at Old Parliament House in the Deputy Speaker's office, and the interview is for the Old Parliament House Oral History Programme. The interviewer is Michael Richards. John, thanks for coming in again today to finish this, well, to keep going with this interview.
Right.
Perhaps we could start with some clarification about the Canberra Times that we finished up on.
Sure. I just wanted to say about the Canberra Times, from the time I arrived in Canberra, first in 52, I had a close association with the Canberra Times. I'd been given an introduction to Charles Meeking, who'd just been appointed editor of the Canberra Times. Was the first. Arthur Shakespeare had been managing editor and continued in that role, but he'd handled the whole of the editorial side and the business side after his father died. And then they appointed Charlie Meeking, who had been press secretary to Menzies earlier on. And so I came down for AUP, and one of Charlie's sons worked at AUP in Sydney. So I had an introduction to him when I arrived, and they gave me hospitality and things when I first came here, the Meekings. But AUP, Australian Auto Press, was in service country newspapers, and Arthur Shakespeare was actually chairman of AUP. And at that time, earlier, the Canberra Times had its own people in the gallery. That ceased, I'm not quite sure when. And then AUP was then responsible for all the political coverage of the Canberra Times.
Why did they cease to have their own people in the
gallery? Oh, I think, the Depression, you see, and the paper only just survived the Depression, because all the projections of population growth and circulation based on that, went to pieces once the Depression took grip, and it had to be revised. So they survived. Through the Depression, so everything was cut back.
Can you put a year on it when they ceased to provide their own coverage? There was a long-running column called From Above the Speaker's Chair. Which they...
Yes, I they can't, wrote. I'd say it was...
And it was certainly going up to about 31.
Yes, well, I'd say it was in the 30s they stopped. It was certainly before the war, I think. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was before the war. I could ask here the Shakespeare, but I can't quite recall that. Had a close relationship with Arthur Shakespeare ultimately too, you see. And when the Canberra Times was looking for a new editor, this is some years later in the 50s, maybe in the early 60s, when Ray Walker died, who'd been editor, I was then second in charge of AUP, and we were asked by Arthur who we thought would, who we'd suggest as an editor. Well, we suggested John Bennett, who was then... political correspondent of the Age, having earlier been on the Melbourne Herald and also the Adelaide News. And Bennett's declined, but proposed David Bowman, who had come across to the gallery from Adelaide to represent the Adelaide News after Bennett's left and went to the Age. And so David Bowman got it. And of course, we'd known and worked together in the gallery, and we had a close link through all that we did for the Canberra Times, but there was a non-poaching agreement between AUP and the Canberra Times so that they wouldn't recruit people from AUP for the Canberra Times direct. So after I'd gone to New Guinea, that didn't apply. So
why was there that non-poaching agreement, given that there was this close relationship anyway?
Well, they didn't feel that they should encroach upon each other's staff, that we were supplying a service for them, which they were happy with, and they didn't... anyway, that was the way it stood. And then when I was up in New Guinea, my wife got sick and indicated I'd like to come back, called Dave, and made that possible then, after Alan Fraser had made some suggestions to me that I was ready to come back.
So was that a happy transition?
Oh, yes, right, very. A very happy transition. And, of course, by the time I got back from New Guinea, the paper had been sold. Oh, no, it happened before I went to New Guinea. It had been sold to Fairfax in 1964, and I went to New Guinea in 65. So, yes, it was a very happy arrangement, and I sort of progressed through things at the Canberra Times from there on.
So perhaps we could talk just briefly about that in itself.
Yes.
It had been sold to Fairfax, so yes, it's no longer owned by a local family.
No.
Did that change the paper much?
Oh, dramatically, yes. Well,
in what way?
Well, resources, and it had been, the Canberra Times originally was a broadsheet publication, and then after Charlie Meeking left, which I think was about 53, 53, I think. Then Lyon Young was appointed. He'd been editor of the Illawarra Mercury down in Wollongong, and he was appointed editor in place of Charlie Meeking. And under him, with the Shakespeare family's approval, the format of the paper was changed from broadsheet to tabloid. But when Fairfax took the paper over in 1964, the immediate decision was to go back to broadsheet, because it was agreed that serious morning newspapers, it was necessary for them to be broadsheet. And of course, John Pringle was appointed editor, who had come out and been editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. He hadn't then been editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, I don't think. But he'd come, the Herald had brought him out. And
I'll take that off you. You're shuffling it.
He'd been. He had had a term as editor. Then he came back to Australia, and was appointed down here as managing editor, which left David Bowman in a slightly awkward position. But he was retained as editor, and. And then of course when Pringle ultimately went back to edit the Herald again, David Bowman became managing editor, and that continued.
And what did you come in as?
I came in as a sub-editor, and then did various things, did the local political reporting and the advisory council and so on, and the beginnings of talk about self-government, and then was appointed chief of staff.
When was that?
In 64, 65, 66, probably in 67, I think, 1967.
And that was your job until you retired?
No, then in 1969, I was appointed news editor, later assistant editor, and then my title was finally changed to deputy editor. And in my last transformation, I was editorial manager.
What does the editorial manager do?
The editorial manager, well, in overseas in Britain and America, the title is managing editor, but it means that, it doesn't mean that in Australia, but editorial manager here means looking after services, handling the industrial work, legal work, and so on. And of course, one of the things I did in that job was also I was the liaison for the officer for the project liaison officer for the Canberra Times when the Mort Street building was sold and the paper was moved to Fyshwick. So I did all the work between the company and the architects and the builders and so on in getting that building up and running.
And tell me, what does the Chief of Staff do?
The Chief of Staff, well, the proper title is Chief of the General Reporting Staff. He organises assignments and assigns reporters to things through the day and so on. It requires quite a bit of organisational work, and you've got to read all the other papers and go through your own paper and follow things up and develop things and so on.
But all the time you're keeping your own hand in as a journalist.
Well, more or less. You don't get a chance to write in the same way, particularly as Chief of Staff. It's not generally a writing job, but it was during that time when I was Chief of Staff that I was approached to write this column for the Sun Herald, a political column. And which, as I think I explained, was initiated by Angus McLaughlin, who was managing director then of the Fairfax Papers. And so the question was whether there'd be union objection if I did it, you see, because as Chief of Staff, you become exempt, so you're no longer. You don't have to. You're out of the union.
You couldn't even belong.
No, you had to. You had to resign.
Mm-hmm.
And so the decision was that it wouldn't appear under my byline. It'd just appear as by our political correspondent.
Did people know who was writing?
Oh, well, as you do things, you have people have to know. Yes, yes. So
it was a polite fiction more than
it was a polite fiction. Yes, and. So I did that, I think, for about 2 years, until I was appointed news editor. Then I felt I couldn't keep it up.
So what years were you doing that?
Well, I became news editor in 69, so okay. It was about...
So it's through those early years of the Whitlam leadership and leading up to the 69
election.
Yes,
I was doing it when Whitlam was... That's right, yes.
Mm.
And it was good fun because I used to go to Parliament House, come over here... Parliament House and go around and talk to people and have a close liaison with Tony Eggleton and so on, and Billy McMahon didn't like it because he was I had a good flow of information about Billy, and when I was critical of him, he used to race down and get the paper and ring up the editor every Sunday morning when things he didn't like appeared.
What did the editor say to him?
Oh, so jollied him along, and I went down to see Billy and worked a few things out with him, but didn't come to anything, you know. That was one of those things that happened.
So let's talk about those years. That was an interesting time to be around the house.
Yes.
You were quite friendly with Arthur Calwell, weren't you?
Yes, Arthur before he became, when he was leader of the opposition. I got to know him particularly on that election tour of 1961, and I used to go down and chat with him now and again in his office. And we just maintained a bit. It wasn't a close thing, but we maintained a link. And when he wrote his book, he inscribed one for me and things like that. So,
can you sum him up? What sort of a person was Arthur Cornwell?
Well, he didn't go down well with everybody, but I found him, you know, quite a warm, friendly sort of person, really. And as I say, he had Doc Everett didn't get on, but he had a good relationship with Menzies and with quite a few, and he built up things in the Labor Party. I think the 61 election campaign boosted his position tremendously. But of course he couldn't, the odds against him repeating it, the odds were against him in repeating it. So then, and of course Whitlam was in the ascendancy, became to be in the ascendancy, and they were completely different people. Arthur had come up through the trade union side of the Labor Party. He was a sort of old style Labor man. Whitlam was the new, younger, you know, Labor person coming up with an academic and professional and background in the law, which up till then you didn't have so many people like that in the Labor Party. Most people had come up through unions and through the Labor Party organisation branches and so on. So, and these guys, you know, they had a lot of depression background, which hung over well into the 60s and 70s, really, with a lot of them. So it was different. So they didn't really get on, Cornwell and Whitlam.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Arthur gave it away, and Whitlam became the leader.
Mm-hmm. Did they have very different styles as leaders as well?
Oh, yes. I mean, Gough was, you know, sort of on high, so to speak. He was, and he, you know, they were completely different. Although, of course, you know, a lot of people didn't like Cornwell too, I suppose, some people. But still, Whitlam bought a sort of much more imperious sort of style to the leadership compared to what the Labor had before.
Mm.
But then, of course, his success, I suppose, was built on a great deal of solid policy work leading up to that 72 election, which helped them tremendously. And of course, McMahon had become Prime Minister, and it was an uninspired time, really, for the government under McMahon.
How would you sum up McMahon?
Well, he built up a bit of a reputation as a minister and being in command of things, but when he became Prime Minister, it didn't carry through.
And hang on, there's a bit of a truck, a forklift, would you believe, going past. And a tractor. We might just hold on for a second.
Sure.
I think they deliberately choose Thursday mornings.
Yeah.
Wait for the light to go on in this room. Okay, that's a bit better. Sorry, can we just go back to McMahon?
Yes. And, you know, he didn't sort of have the command or the presence that, you know, you expect of a Prime Minister, I suppose. And he didn't have the same respect.
Did he have any sort of a relationship with the press?
Oh, yes. Well, he leaked considerably to the press, to selected press people.
And that didn't win him respect, though?
Didn't necessarily win him respect. I mean, he was... if you read what Hasluck says about him in Chance of Politics, that really sort of sums Billy up. And it's pretty damn... Menzies didn't like him. He had a certain backing in the New South Wales Liberal Party amongst, you know, people like the Lloyd Joneses and people like that, and of course Packer, and there was a close link there with Packer and the Telegraph and so on.
But not with the Fairfax
Press? Not so much with the Fairfax Press, no.
Mm, mm.
No, but he still managed to exert him by himself. And of course he used to ring people up endlessly and... go on and complain to editors and things like that, you know. But
and that had some effect some of the time?
Oh, some of the time, I suppose. You know, when he used to ring up the Sun Herald and complain, then go down and say, oh, I talked for him, see what you can do, and I did that, and I think I ran a few things about him a bit more positively than than before, but we didn't really compromise our position.
Do you think journalists from the major press groups have, in your time, compromised under that sort of pressure? Can you think of any glaring examples of that?
I can't think of an example of that. Not really. I think we were the sort of principles we worked to were held to, I think, and were greatly respected by the Fairfax organisation. It may have been a bit different on other papers, like the Daily Telegraph or so on, but in the main, that was adhered to. I know when I was in New Guinea, and the paper had been bought by the Melbourne Herald, and I had trouble with Burns Philp over a story we ran, and managing director of the Herald, Williams, wrote to Burns Philp and threatened to close the Herald papers to their advertising, and that they had to, again, told them they had to accept that they couldn't influence the editorial columns of the paper, of the South Pacific Post or any other Melbourne Herald paper. So, you know, I didn't expect to get support to that extent, but it was quite a, and that was the general principle. And of course in those days, you know, I think we tried to be as objective as possible as you can be, you know, in handling political things, and most of us, there were a few exceptions. Now, we never had any political links. We never belonged to any party. Although Alan Reid was a card-carrying member of the Labor Party.
And the Lang part of that.
Lang part of that,
to be precise.
So, that was an exception. You know, people tried to keep their... adhered to being... not having those involvements.
Mm. 69 campaign is often talked about as the first campaign in which television played a really major role.
I suppose it was. I was at the Canberra Times then, so I wasn't directly involved so much.
But were you conscious that there was this new kid on the block as far as political reporting was concerned?
Oh, yes. Well, I think before I left the gallery, we had been conscious of that it was certainly coming. And, of course, it was in its early days when I described that press conference of Menzies. it was in its early days, and it developed from them, from that. And of course the see, radio became much bigger too than it had been previously in terms of political reporting. And those developments, the TV and radio matching it, changed the sort of the way of political reporting, I think, to a large extent.
Changed it in the newspapers as well?
In the newspapers as well.
What was the change to the newspapers? Were you trying to compete on the same terms?
Well, yes, you were competing in those terms, but they were really different mediums and you had to approach things differently. But gradually, the parliamentary coverage shrank in the print media, and that proceedings in the House became secondary to the things outside, and question time was given pride of place. The concentration was on that and on the clashes in politics. We had certainly covered those, but they didn't have the they didn't dominate in the way they began to, with who wins or loses in question time. And the complexion of question time changed. See, question time was meant to be a where members and others can extract information from ministers about the administration and running of their departments. Whereas, the answers and the questions became more political and more structured. Both the parties, as this trend gathered momentum, there were meetings before the House met to decide on questions, the line that would be taken on questions, and who would ask the questions. So that it wasn't just free for any member to pop up and ask a question as it had been. See, it wasn't structured in that way before that, through those Menzies years at all. Nothing like that went on. But so it developed.
And what do you think was the larger result of that change? Does it change the type of leadership that's exerted on the floor of the House?
I think it does, and it diminishes the actual role of Parliament in I think the way it's probably meant to perform. Members do have a responsibility. Everything became much more controlled, and I don't think that adds to the quality of what happens in Parliament. That's my view, and Keating used to talk about the drip. He'd give information to selected people, and if you're on that, well, then you're compromising your position, I think. And he was apt to ring up and abuse editors and so on about things he didn't like and so forth.
Well, that's going back to the relationship with proprietors, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Not so much to do with question time as...
Oh, no, that's so, but that's, all that. And then, of course, the old style of press conference changed. You didn't have those sort of... as TV... Oh, sorry.
It's all right.
And radio... developed, you didn't have those more formal press conferences. Then the doorstop developed.
When did the doorstop develop?
I don't know, it must have been in the 70s, I think. So it was certainly in the 80s, yes, and developed. That changed things again.
Does it change more than simply the way politicians communicate? Does it actually change the type of people who succeed as politicians? I'm just wondering how someone like Sir George Pearce would have coped with a doorstop.
I don't think he would have, myself.
Or even even Menzies, but then Menzies could cope with sort of pressure.
He could probably adapt to that, but with some difficulty, I think. You know, he wasn't that style of person. He was a more person who expected things to be done in a certain way. And so I don't... he probably would have adapted to it, but it would have been with some difficulty, I think, yeah.
Does the doorstop come in because the technology changes, or is it something that comes in from overseas, perhaps?
I think probably the Americans developed over there, I think, more than anywhere. And I think it... politicians like it, I think, probably because it's it doesn't last long, and it's generally on a specific subject, whereas at a broader press conference you have wide-ranging exchange and more time for the press to question.
It was one of the great Whitlam innovations, wasn't it? The regular press conference.
Yes.
What about McMahon? Was he comfortable with such things?
Oh, he had them, but I don't know that he had them as frequently as Whitlam. And I mean, Menzies didn't have a regular press conference. There were, perhaps earlier on, there was more. We saw him. There were more regular press conferences, but then they fell away too, and they were rather as he felt like it, you know. But you could make representations through the press section and all that, and ask things and so on. I mean, it wasn't that we didn't have access. We did, and Eggleton and people like that, Hugh Dash and Ray Maley, were good at, fielding your stuff and trying to get stuff out to you.
What was Gorton like? We haven't talked about him at all.
Well, difficult. I had somebody. Gorton was became Prime Minister when I was still doing the Sun Herald column, and I got on okay with Gorton. He... and I could arrange through Tony to see him if need be, which I did on one or two occasions, I think. And the editor of Sun Herald wrote to him and asked that I be given access and so forth. So that was quite good. I think he was different. People found it hard, and and they found it hard to cope with Ainslie Gotto as his principal private secretary. And
what was difficult about that?
Well, take senior public servants like Jack Bunting, who was then initial stages, then it changed later, head of Prime Minister and Cabinet. He'd appear over there and he'd say, "Is the Prime Minister free?" Oh, she said, "No, not just at the moment. John, would you mind taking a seat?" Well, the familiarity of being called John by the secretary, a 20-year-old secretary, was a bit hard to take for some of these guys. It was a different style. And Gorton was free and easy. I think he was put down, and you know, it was the thing with Fraser and it all blew up, and Gorton was out, but there were things I think he did, and he helped to free a lot of things up in ways that hadn't been before, and there's a bit more flexibility, I think.
Did he have a good honeymoon with the press? Was the press fairly critical from the start?
Oh, no, he was quite good. I mean, he'd been Navy Minister, been Minister for the Navy, and then Education, and he'd done well at Navy, it was he who brought, I think it was under him as Minister for Navy, had brought Eggleton to Canberra and put him into the Navy as Public Relations Officer. And Tony handled that well. Before the Voyager incident, there had been another incident down at Jervis Bay where the involving, I think, the destroyers Tobruk and Anzac, and those had practiced target shoot, and a shell had gone astray, and Tobruk had an Anzac had been holed below the waterline or on the waterline, and this was quite an incident of the day. And on Eggleton's advice, Gorton informed the press immediately and told them what had happened, and then arrangements were made for a party of us to be flown down to Nowra and then to Jervis Bay to have a look and go to the Nowra base, and then out to the we were flown out to Melbourne, which was off the coast, which was doing things off the coast of Jervis Bay, and then we were brought back to Jervis Bay, and in the afternoon we were taken out to the Anzac and were able to interview and talk to the captain. So all that went down well.
Now, you're implying that that's different from how it might have been handled earlier.
Yes.
Would there have been a cover-up, do you think?
It might have been, well, more, it would have been played down, whereas this, it was laid quite open, and we went down and got the story, and, from the people involved.
Does that come from Tony Eggleton, or does it come from Gorton?
I think it was on Eggleton's advice. Yes, I know it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Gorton was open to go with those sort of things, and to give and it went down well, you see.
Mm.
And perhaps Voyager might have been handled a bit differently. He'd have been there, but he wasn't. And he'd already just moved to education in that cabinet reshuffle, ministry reshuffle.
What went wrong with Voyager? What was From your perspective, what was going on?
Well, it was difficult to see. There was Cheney, who'd been appointed Minister for the Navy, but the legislation hadn't gone through to enlarge the cabinet, so that Jim Falls, who'd been appointed Minister for the Army, had to act. Although everything was going through Cheney, and he was making decisions in concert with Forbes. But it was difficult, and it was a disaster that came out of the blue, that everybody was a bit at sea about how to handle it. I mean, Menzies, I think, probably rightly set up a Royal Commission and so on, but and there was, you know, people looking for who to blame, who was at fault, and it fell between Robertson, the commander of the Melbourne, and Stevens, the commander of the Voyager. And the allegations about Stevenson being under the influence of drink and so on, but of course he was dead. But Robertson was there, and perhaps Robertson got the worst end of it, because really he finished his career. And of course there was the initial inquiry, and then there was a move through John Jess, a Liberal from Victoria, for a second inquiry. And it didn't clarify really all that much, things all that much, I don't think.
How important was the media in pushing for that continuing inquiry? Or was it really coming from within Parliament?
Well, it was coming within Parliament, and I don't quite remember what the editorial stance on it was, but I think people were looking for answers, so anything that might produce an answer, they were willing to go with. And it was a very interesting thing, you know, how an accident like that would happen on such a night with perfect, almost perfect weather conditions.
But just looking at it in a larger sense,
yes.
We don't really have the investigative reporting tradition that some of the American newspapers
and
have.
And the British too.
And the British.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. We have given it a fly at different times. It's been done, but not really well, I suppose, in today. Most of the investigative stuff seems to come out of the ABC through Four Corners and programs like that. I mean, Four Corners particularly, I think. And there are risks involved in investigative reporting, you know, legal risks. But then, you know, the papers are equipped to deal with them. They all have lawyers at hand whenever needed. And I think, of course, you see, commercial interests come into play much more now than they used to, as far as the press is concerned, particularly newspapers. And the bottom line tends to dominate. That's my view.
Is that because the papers are part of larger ownership groups that include those commercial interests, or is it simply that they're not as good at standing up to them as
well,
in the Mansfield instance that you quoted?
They're probably not as good as standing up to them, and the proprietors are not as clear in what they're about. You might call it their mission, you know. The old Fairfax Company, not the present one, believed from coming down through the family that they had a responsibility to publish newspapers in a certain way, in a way that, you know, they thought they were doing a public duty. So that a lot of things were done, and there wasn't, so even if you overspent or things like that, if it could be justified from an editorial point of view, it was accepted. That sort of flexibility is not always there these days, as I understand. I mean, I'm out of it now, but this is what I understand, is it's, you don't have that freedom.
Did you see that change take place, do you think, while you were still in the industry?
Not really, because I think it was beginning, but I left the Canberra Times in 1988, which was just after the Fairfax papers were sold, after Warwick's debacle, young Warwick's debacle. So I didn't see that. I've been an observer, I think, of it more. But at the Canberra Times, see, we were there. I was deputy editor, and I was often acting as editor for quite considerable periods over the years I was there. And I can hardly remember a single instance of interference from Sydney about anything that we were doing. You know, we were able to virtually run the paper as we thought we ought to, and we did. That same freedom I don't think is available today. I mean, there was only one instance, or maybe two instances I can remember, when John Pringle, who'd been editor of the Herald, of course, had written a book called Have Pen, We'll Travel, We Will Travel. And in it he'd made a reference to a Herald sub-editor, chief sub-editor, or acting news editor on a Sunday, who had got frustrated or something, was throwing things out the window and and so on. And we were told, well, you know, just be careful in how you treat any reviews of the book. It didn't alter what we did. We just went ahead and reviewed in the other way. And the other, only other instance I remember was that, there was a person out in the country somewhere who was on a charge of buggery. And we'd reported the charge as on the charge sheet at the court as buggery. And Sir Warwick made rather sensations to the editor. He didn't think we should have said that. We should have used some euphemism to get around it. But that was the sort of approach in those days.
And did you change? What?
No, but it had already appeared. It already appeared, so we took it on board, and that was that. And then in 1980, we had a strike. The journalists were on strike. That's right, the journalists were on strike for about 6 weeks. And so about half a dozen of us, executives and exempt people, got out the paper. We still had the printers and all that, but you know, it meant working, beginning in the morning about 11 and going through till late at night or even into the early hours the next morning, and then starting again all over again. So after that, we Ian Matthews decided to write a, he was then editor, wrote an article about describing how we'd done this, you see. But we were told we shouldn't have done that because the Herald played things very straight in the union way. They felt it might upset the unions, you see. Although it had been a union matter and they'd caused the trouble, but they thought we shouldn't sort of beat our breasts about it in any way. But they were really minor things, you know, when you consider it. And we didn't have to, if we contradicted Herald or policy or any other, it didn't matter. Nobody worried about that. We wrote editorials as we thought they should be written on the subjects we thought we should deal with.
So what, in what capacity were you working at the time of the dismissal in 75?
In 75, I think in 75 I had been news editor that year. I was news editor in 75, but I'd in that year we'd had a family tragedy, and my eldest son was killed in an accident. And it was on Canberra Day. And I always remember because Gordon Bryant, who was Minister for Capital Territory, had declared it that the holiday would be held on the day, the 12th of March. And so I had to go off. And my wife and I, we had a break away and so on after that. And I came back again briefly acting as chief of staff again to give me time to work out. And I was offered, could have done that or gone to the, we had a little other paper called The Courier, which we were bringing out as a free paper as well. And I was offered to go over there, but I stayed as chief of staff for a while, filling in. And then later on, when I got more back on top of things, I became assistant editor.
So it was a difficult time for you, 75.
Yeah, 75 was a difficult time.
Yeah.
And Max Prisk, who later became editor of the Herald, Sydney Morning Herald, he came in as news editor.
Mm-hmm.
And he then worked sort of under me as news editor. And so gradually then I moved more as assistant editor. I had charge of all the feature side of the paper, and ran the library and all that non-news side of the paper. Arranged for, you know, reviews, all the arts and books and all that side of the paper, and ordinary news features as well.
Well, bearing that in mind, I'm just wondering if you had any particular reflections on 75.
I was a little detached from it, but of course it was a tremendous news story, and you know, the way I was involved and the way we handled it and so forth. But well, it was unprecedented, and
you didn't see the writing on the wall, did you? Was there a general expectation in the
No, I think it was a surprise. I don't think it was considered that it would come to that, or expected that it would quite come to that. I mean, Fraser was, you know, going on about supply and all that, and the government was, the opposition was being difficult and saying they were doing this and that. But I think the way it happened was not expected.
What was the general feeling in the press? Was there outrage or simply detachment in reporting it?
Well, it was a bit of both, I think. I think they thought the Whitner had probably been hardly done by, certainly initially. And yes, I think... well, the sympathy was for with Whitlam, rather than with,
even though the previous year had been a chaotic one.
Well, the previous year had been chaotic with Kemlani and all that loans affair, which was the sort of lead up to all this. And I think by that time, a lot of people were beginning to be disillusioned about the Whitlam government and the way things had were going on. At the same time, the way it was done was a bit of a shock to people, I think, or certainly a surprise. But having adjusted to it, of course, and as things came out, then I think the sort of things swung behind Fraser. Well, as the election in December showed.
But you felt that was happening in the media as well as in the population?
To some extent, but not entirely. Whitlam's always retained, in the media and outside, I think, you know, that he was a bit hardly done by.
And a real sense of there being a following, there being admirers.
Yeah, being admirers of Whitlam. And you see, the Labor Party tends to make... martyrs and heroes of failures. That's a trend through Labor history. And I think that's happened, you see. Because I think Whitlam did a lot of initial things that were good, I think, as Gorton had done on the other side of politics. But, you know, it wasn't really good government in the end, you know, when you had things with, over the loans, Rex Connors and all those other things that went on.
How has he been able to retain that respect and even that love and admiration?
Sort of, he's commanding, he commands a presence with them, and... And he's also able to, he's arrogant, but he's able to get away with he's able to get away with his arrogance somehow. I don't know. I mean, I first met Whitlam at the when I was in Sydney at the doing the state political correspondent earlier on before I went to that, when the Liquor Royal Commission was in progress under Justice Maxwell, and Dovey, Whitlam's son-in-law, Dovey QC, was Bill Dovey was
father-in-law,
yeah, was appearing as assisting the Royal Commissioner, and Whitlam was his junior. And you know, you'd go up to the court and try and get some briefing or something which from Whitlam, and he was most objectionable and arrogant about giving information, and, you know, short and sharp, and you know, difficult to deal with. I mean, he did grow out of that, I think, a bit as when he got into politics, but of course he wasn't in politics at that stage. He was just a lawyer working at the bar. And that, yes, well, in his, I don't know, it just remains there, but I think he's a bit overrated. That's my personal view, but other people may see him differently. And of course he has this tendency to make speeches that go on forever these days.
Indeed. Is there anyone else you want to talk about? Who would be the journalists that you have admired the most in your career in relation to Parliament especially? And who are your role models perhaps, or the people you'd hold up as very good examples to somebody entering the profession now?
Well, it's difficult to say, of course. Alan Reid was a good operator, there's no question about that, but then there were people equally as good, I suppose, in different ways. I mean, Harold Cox from the Melbourne Herald was good, and so was Ian Fitchett. I think out of those, I liked Fitchett best.
Tell me about Fitchett. What made him good?
Well, he sort of he was a person you could underrate, but he had good contacts with Menzies, with McEwen, and with other people. And he wasn't he was a character, but he produced the goods. He wrote a good column each week for The Age and then later for The Herald. And but then you always had to watch what Cox was likely to come up with. And he was a good operator for the Melbourne Herald. Hal Myers, as political correspondent for the Herald, was good too in his day, before Fitchett, when Fitchett was still with The Age.
But we began this interview with you talking about your admiration for Philip Gibbs, and none of them sound like a Philip Gibbs character. I mean, Gibbs walks a larger stage, doesn't he?
He walks a larger stage. He wasn't confined to politics. And he was a more free-ranging person, and, say, had been a war correspondent and so on. I mean,
there's no Australian in that mould?
Oh, well, there is. Alan Moorhead would come close to that. Alan Winchester Wilmot, and probably Osmer White, but perhaps in a different way. But they were good correspondence, and they produced good material, good stuff.
George Johnson.
George Johnson. Well, George approached the war differently. George was never up with fighting. George operated back at headquarters, whereas Moorhead and people like that, Wilmot, White, and of course Damien Parris, photographer, and others, well, they were out there where the action was. And Fitchett too. See, Fitchett was a war correspondent too. He was Australian. Well, he was became assistant official Australian war correspondent in the Middle East, assistant to Slessor, and acted as the correspondent until Slessor got there. And then, of course, he was appointed Australian official correspondent of the 8th Division in Malaya before the fall of Singapore. Fortunately, he got out in time and then went on to work for the Daily Express for the rest of the war later. But so, you know, they operated on a stage that perhaps, you know, you didn't have that scope when you can just confine to politics. So, and of course, as Rowan Rivett said, you know, some of the best reporting of World War II was produced by Australians. And there were others, British, like Christopher Buckley and so on, who did great things in the war as well. But
well, what is it that makes a good reporter? Can you sum that up? Got about 4 minutes here.
It's difficult. That's a difficult question, Michael. I really don't know. It's a determination to get the story, I suppose, and be in the right place at the right time too. Often, sometimes you're not, and you've just got to. It's an indefinable thing, I really think. Some people seem to be able to come up with it, and some are not so good. But you've got to be, you know, strive for accuracy and to really tell the story as you see it, if you can do that. And I think, and you've got to have a feeling for the whatever situation you're in and really be able to convey that and convey what the people who are the actors in it all are, and across, you've got to get them across too. But that's a difficult question.
Well, perhaps we should finish on that one.
Good.
Thanks, many thanks. Last question.
Yes.
There are lots of stories about the fact that there was no toilet for women in the reps gallery. Do you remember that?
No, that's the strange thing about it. I don't. And we had, at the time, we had, you know, women senators, Dorothy Tagney and others, a couple of others, and also we had Helga Sunstrup, who was a Daily Telegraph in the gallery, then later a girl from the ABC. Nobody ever complained about it. I never heard anything about it. It just didn't sort of impinge at the time.
So in your day, it was a gents' toilet on the reps' gallery side.
On the reps'
and
gallery.
It remained that.
It remained that as far as I can remember. And I don't remember. I think there was one down. Wasn't there one off King's Hall, or women's?
On the floor below.
Floor below, yes. Mm. That's right, yeah.
So a long way to go if you're
long
in a hurry.
Long way to go, yes. But obviously, somehow they must have worked something out, those girls who worked here earlier.